Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello, and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Nancy Fechne. Nancy is an engineer turned founder turned investor, currently a partner at Towerview Ventures, an alumni ventures fund backed by many Duke LPs. She is on the advisory board of Empath Ventures, an early stage psychedelics fund, and has just joined the advisory team of Bastion Capital, a crypto hedge fund out of Miami. She is a venture partner at Gangels, a leading LGBTQIA plus investment syndicate and fund, a partner at Flight Ventures, the largest group of online investors in the world, and just in case that wasn't enough, can be found kite surfing or catching a game of pickleball somewhere in the great state of Texas or around the globe in her spare time, if she can find any. Nancy, it's absolutely wonderful to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So let's jump straight in. I was kind of running out of breath just introducing me. And the question has to be asked, where do you find the time to do everything you do? And out of everything, what gets your heart racing the most? And what would you do if it were the only thing that you could do?
Well, obviously, kite surfing gets my heart racing the most. It's a very adrenaline pumping sport. But truth be told, I think I'll answer this a bit philosophically. You know, time is just a construct that we've created for ourselves. It's really about how what we choose to prioritize and what we choose to do with our awake hours. And, you know, thinking about Parkinson's law, you really only have enough time as you give yourself to complete certain tasks. And if you give yourself a pretty heavy docket of things you want to get done, I guarantee you'll get those things done. As long as you're a motivated individual, you'll still fit it all in. And I'll also say, you know, truth be told, I am very lucky to have an amazing support system around me, both in my personal life and at work. And at Alumni, I'm supported by an incredible team of fellows and my partner, Greg Baker. And at Gangels and Flight, well, they pretty much co-invest with each other now, and they're kind of one bucket. And the board seats are just a fun thing I do in my free time. I actually surprisingly have a very good work-life balance. And I think if I could only do one thing, I would run a positive impact fund focused on health, tech, wellness, psychedelics, Web3, financial inclusion, the hint of climate, if I could find some really great deals.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I think this whole topic of time being just a construct is really important. It's something that I've started realizing, I think the more I've gotten into my founding journey and beyond that, if you can fill your time with the things that you love doing, then it's as if you've got all the time in the world. I think that the difficulty for so many of us is when we end up doing things or tasks that, you know, don't engage us, they feel like they're dragging on our time. One of the reasons, you know, I love doing this podcast, one of the reasons we've, you know, recorded something like 40 episodes in the last couple of months, it feels like, is because it is very much something that, you know, I love doing. And I really enjoy talking to the guests that we have on, and, you know, obviously including yourself. And I think, you know, the one thing that really comes through with all of the things that you are doing, they're all, you know, themed around investment and helping startups and helping, you know, early stage ventures really grow, which I think, you know, obviously says something very much about where your passion lies outside of, you know, the travel and the sports. But you've been with some really heavy hitting names like Kleiner Perkins and Techstars, but you're now associated with arguably smaller or less well-known funds. So for our listeners, what are the challenges of kind of downsizing, and equally, what does it allow you to do that you couldn't in those bigger organizations?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. Just to clarify, because I don't think many people realize this or know this, that Alumni is actually quite large. I only joined a year ago, but since inception, Alumni has deployed close to $1 billion in capital into the startup ecosystem. And it's a relatively new model for venture investing, certainly less established in terms of brand than Kleiner and Techstars, but it's moving towards breaking down barriers for LPs who want to get involved in top tier deals, but can't afford the minimum check size or even get into the funds of, you know, Sequoia, Kleiner, Andreessen, et cetera. So I think that's worth noting. As far as, you know, it's underlying, you're kind of asking about my decision and equally what that changed for me. The decision was also to find work-life balance. I think it's very rare in venture to have that. And because of the amazing support we get at alumni, I'm able to have that work-life balance and still do what I love. And like you were saying earlier, if you're doing what you love, it doesn't feel like you're working. And that's a beautiful way to spend your life. The main difference between alumni and Kleiner, I would say, is that alumni doesn't lead deals, meaning my job is very different. So, you know, a fund that leads, you're doing very deep dive due diligence. You might spend, you know, a month to, you know, 2 months, maybe longer, depending on the stage of the deal, due diligencing it. Versus at alumni, we can turn around a deal if we need to in 2 weeks. And that's because we put a lot of weight on who that lead investor is. And Gangels and Plight are pretty similar in that sense that, you know, they're not leading. And so it's a much lighter touch due diligence process. It's easier on the founders too. And it makes our jobs a lot easier. And that means I get to focus on, you know, building relationships as well as supporting the portfolio companies with the network that I've built over the last 15 years, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's a couple of things I'd really love to kind of pick up on there. One thing you just said earlier was the difference between the funds you're with now and say the larger funds like Kleiner Perkins, et cetera, is around brand, right? But today, a lot of the emerging funds and certainly some of the fund managers we've had on the podcast even seem to have built these incredible brands, certainly on Twitter. They're really well known within the ecosystem. How do you think those larger firms are keeping up with that? I mean, there's been sort of, you know, index partners doing TikTok videos and this sort of stuff, but like how important is that brand aspect becoming? And are these larger firms able to keep up, I guess?
Well, I mean, Kleiner has certainly changed over the years. And I don't know that I wouldn't say that it's exactly the brand it was when I was, you know, when I was lucky enough to work there back in 2014. I think there's been a lot of turnover and change of guard, and that happens with time as people go off and start their own funds or retire. And so I think it's unfortunate and sad, but it is what it is. As far as others like Benchmark, Bessemer, Andreessen, Sequoia that have been around for quite some time and have always been a big name brand, I think they've all handled it differently. I mean, you look at Andreessen and they've hired a ton of young partners and made them GPs. And, you know, some people make fun of them for it, but honestly, I think it was really smart because they went out there and they hired people that had the networks that were still young enough to be the same age as a lot of those founders and can handle, you know, the crazy social life that we have to maintain as young partners, you know, going from conference to conference. I'm flying out on Thursday to one summit, then I go straight to Bitcoin Miami, and then I'm heading up to New York at the end of the month. It's just, you have to continue to build your network. And that, I think, was really smart of Andreessen to hire a lot of people that can do that. I'm not really sure how Benchmark and Bessemer have stayed, you know, at the top with their old guard as part of the old guard. Probably have to get one of their partners on to talk about that. But from the perspective of what we can do as a fund in order to really maintain that brand, I think it is really actually timely. I'm reading a book about how to change your opinion on life and how we get stuck in our opinions. And I think as investors, we, especially, you know, at old name funds, they may get stuck in their brand and think that it's going to hold weight till the end of time. But you have to continue to innovate, just like the companies we're investing in. We have to innovate ourselves and make sure that we're staying, you know, ahead of the curve, whether it be getting investors on board to invest in Web3 that know what they're doing, or changing the model so that you're incredibly helpful to your portfolio companies, or TikTok videos. All of them, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do to stay relevant.
You know, as you were talking there, I think one of the things that came to mind was Andreessen Horowitz launching Future and turning the whole kind of machine of A16Z into this kind of content engine, which both acts as an attractor of talent as well as a way of them pushing out kind of their thoughts on what's happening in the, you know, in the ecosystem in general. And obviously Sonal Choksi, who kind of heads up a lot of that and, you know, certainly launched their podcast some years ago, has been, you know, an incredible resource, I think, to founders as well as investors in the ecosystem, and has really kind of pushed that, I guess, that framework of being both an investor as well as a media, as well as an education kind of institution, to really help both founders as well as other investors in the ecosystem.
Yeah. And also, you know, you look at it and a lot of them in the last few years have ramped up their seed investing. So they get in early, get to know the founders early, and then they can snatch that later stage round. And I think it's because it's gotten more competitive, they have had to make those moves.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I remember talking to Scottish equity partners some years ago, who obviously are at the private equity end of the scale. And they were saying they were coming into, or at least looking at sort of the Series A, Series B type rounds, so that they could ensure that they had the pipeline coming into those later stages when they're looking at those businesses once they'd reached kind of equilibrium. And I guess the same things happen for those later stage funds. They're coming in at seed so they can, you know, ensure that they can see the upside and as well as those great outcomes and great businesses very early on. And one of the other things I think that you mentioned there is breaking down, you know, you talked about breaking down barriers to LPs. This is another topic that I think is really, really important right now. So there's been a massive proliferation of, you know, early stage fund managers raising micro funds, so small sort of $5 million to $10 million funds, often taking LP checks of, you know, $1,000 in some instances, but certainly not, you know, necessarily kind of taking the larger checks, which I think is really positive because it allows for more participants in the venture ecosystem. Not all of us can be angels. Not all of us have an understanding necessarily of, you know, what it takes to be a great investor in early stage businesses. How do you think that kind of that whole, you know, ecosystem of LPs has changed, or has it changed, or are you seeing differences in, I guess, the nature of those LPs and where the money's coming from, or the sums that are being deployed?
I mean, there are definitely more LPs. That's been the case for some time, though. It seems like everybody is getting into venture. You know, people that were just kind of watching from afar before, like hedge funds, are in venture. A lot of private equity shops have moved earlier and earlier. So, and then you've got a huge opportunity for angels to come in. And so those angels are getting their feet wet with angel investing through AngelList or Republic or, you know, other opportunities similar. Crowdcube, I think, is one out of the UK. And, you know, those individuals then want to write LP checks. But if they can write a 1K to 10K LP check through a fund, either, I mean, ours is like, I think, 50K or 25K minimum. But if they can write those LP checks through AngelList funds or their rolling funds or to their friend's micro fund that's only 5 million or 2 million or 10 million, you know, they are doing that and they're getting excited about doing that. Do I think there will be a market correction? Absolutely. You know, if you're raising a fund right now, go raise as quickly as humanly possible. If you're raising a startup round, go raise as quickly as possible, because we cannot continue with these crazy valuations and the amount of money that's coming into the space. I can't fathom it actually continuing for a number of years from this point. So I think, just like any bubble, we may be sitting in one and I'm just waiting for it to burst.
Yeah, I think a lot of us would echo that sentiment. And just again, as you were talking there, you know, apart from angels being able to get into primary deals on platforms like WeFunder, Crowdcube, et cetera, here in the UK, certainly we've had both Passion Capital and Jamjar, who, you know, you are almost certainly familiar with from your time here, have raised certainly in part some of their funds on platform or via seeders, as an example, allowing for, you know, LPs to come in for as little as, you know, 10, 50, 100, 100 pounds, which is incredible, right?
Yeah. And then there was Draper, I think, was the first that ever took their fund public, right? How many years ago was that? 2017 or something? It's definitely before I left. And Simon, I think, announced it. It was really cool. It's just like there are new models being, you know, created in venture. You've got tokenized funds, you've got DAO funds, like we talked about before, building a group of amazing females in Web3 to create an SPV to invest in a new DAO fund. I mean, that model really fascinates me, if you want me to go off on a tangent. But that aside, I think the venture space is changing, and for the better in the most part. There's also another company called Sweater VC that I think is pretty interesting. You should check out. They're doing something similar to like an ETF, I believe, for the venture space and making it very easy for non-accredited investors to invest.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be the natural kind of, you know, progression of where we're going with venture. Interestingly, I am actually part of a DAO fund. So Consilience Ventures, we had the founder, Kevin Montserrat, on the podcast very early on. And it's really incredible, right, to understand how that works. And it has its challenges, but it's certainly part of the future, if not, you know, the future. So look, I mean, in a pod with Dan Taylor, who's an editor, or he's actually, I think, the managing editor at tech.eu last year, you talked a lot about your passion for promoting diversity in venture. But what I would really like to understand was what triggered that in the first place? And at what point did you say to yourself, this needs to change?
Well, I've been a minority, I guess, since I was 18 because I went to an all-girls high school and then I went into engineering school. And so in engineering school, I think the odds that you were female were something like 1 out of 12. And then I went into venture and startup where mainly men around me. It does not feel weird to me when I go and sit down at a table of 10 people and I'm the only female. I don't even notice it anymore. So it's something that I feel passionate about because I've experienced it myself. And I think that we can also create a better world if we put people from diverse backgrounds together. It creates more innovation and it creates actually better returns for your investors, which most people don't realize. I started being active and intentional about my decisions in order to impact the imbalance probably around 2015, I would say, when I started Female Founders Dinner Club with Leila Zenya, who runs a fund out of London. And we brought together females who had raised venture funding and were the type of female that wanted to lift each other up. And that was the first thing I did, and amongst other things that I've done in the, you know, in the last 7 years, but mainly focusing on supporting females, supporting any kind of minority through, you know, Gangels as well, and being an advocate for them. Because if we don't all try and change this problem, it's not going to change. It's too easy to have unconscious bias. It's too easy to just invest in or support your friends. And those are usually people who grew up like you, look like you, have a lot in common with you. You have to go out and try and seek other opportunities to change the imbalance that we've inadvertently created.
Yeah, I think there is a really important takeaway there. I think I mentioned to you earlier, I was on a WhatsApp group where we had a VC. It's a WhatsApp group that is targeted towards Africa. And, you know, there's a VC basically saying something along the lines of pedigree is really important, like which school you went to, you know, which company you worked at, you know, what your network is like. And I kind of was just sat there saying, but if you're a guy in Ghana or if you're a woman in, you know, Mozambique, how are you going to have access those networks? How likely is it that you are going to have been to those schools or had those opportunities? And I think it's really important for us to remove our thinking that, you know, great companies can be born only from, you know, from those institutions. I think it's a circular argument in that, you know, yes, so many great companies have come out of those institutions, but only because those are the companies that are getting funding. And I think it comes back to something we were talking about just before around the LPs, which is if you can create more diversity in your LP base, that filters down through to, you know, to the GPs, and the GPs then deploy into more diverse founders who, you know, who are building diverse teams. And as they exit, that kind of capital recycles through the system. I think that's super, super important.
Yeah, I would add, though, I think it's a chicken and egg issue. You know, if you have more people of diversity in powerful decision-making positions, they are going to attract those that are like them. And they are likely going to result in more investments in diverse founders. And on the flip side, if you have more diverse founders that are in positions of power or, you know, where others can look and see someone like them that exists and has been successful, they'll inspire more founders like them to try. And if we could just maybe solve those two things, it will quickly, I think, have a domino effect on the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. So just changing kind of tack for a second, you were based in the UK for several years and you still travel extensively. You've been in Australia, Bali, and plenty of other destinations. How would you describe the attitude to venture in the UK compared to the US? And how has your experience traveling the globe informed you as an investor? And I'd love for you to talk to us about something you've talked about before, i.e. the founder high.
Well, man, I think I coined that term on Harry Stebbings' podcast over 5 years ago. So it's been quite a while since someone's asked me about it. But I was with Founders High, I was thinking about the energy that you get when you're around a founder that is so excited about their idea and just brilliant, incredible human being that is living their dream. And you walk away from that meeting on a high. You're just so excited with them. It's an energy transaction that occurs. And I get addicted to that for sure. And that's what I was talking about when I brought it up around the UK and EU question and, you know, how that has informed my decision around the world as well. I think it gives you perspective and a better understanding. And also it changes your scale. And what I mean by the scale is, you know, if you look at the range of companies that come out of different regions of the world, you have like the best of the best, and then you have the bottom of the barrel. And where that scale moves based on where you're living or what kind of founders you're around matters. It also matters in how you invest. So if you see, you know, usually companies that are the best of the best, you're, you know, measure of what you need to find or have in order to invest is going to be much higher than if you're setting that bar a bit lower and you've never seen the best of the best, you've only seen good, you're going to think the good is the best and you're going to invest in every single one. So I think that is how it's impacted me. Also understanding cultural differences, that is huge. US founders, Americans, as we are taught to be bold and dream big and speak very highly of ourselves. In fact, I think a lot of Americans are taught to embellish their accomplishments and beat their chest. Whereas you talk to someone from, let's say, Scandinavia or that region of the world. And, you know, I was on the phone the other day with someone from Stockholm, and I was like, you need to speak more confidently about your accomplishments if you're going to talk to US investors, because they're expecting that. And that's the minimum for them. They're used to being told all these amazing things that this founder has accomplished, and you're downplaying your accomplishments. It's not going to serve you. And so because I've lived all over the place, there are generalizations I know about different cultures that have helped me help founders and also helped me suss out whether a founder maybe is just being too humble. Brits tend to do it too. I worked with a lot of founders when I was living in London, and I would spend the first 20 minutes just listening to them. And the rule was they just had to talk for 20 minutes and tell me all the things they could think of about their company and what they've done. And then I would compare that to their elevator pitch, and they were night and day because they didn't even know what to say that would make them sound good. And they felt uncomfortable bragging about themselves. So there's just a lot of interesting, unique differences you have to look at culturally to really understand the investment and try and assess them on an equal playing field, if that makes sense.
100%. I mean, I think here in the UK, we're very self-deprecating. There is this sort of, we shy away from, as you say, from talking about our talents or our achievements because it's seen as slightly unseemly and a bit like boasty. But I think there's also just different attitudes. So one of the things I've talked about before on this podcast, I think, is, you know, in the US, the attitude to failure is much more positive than say in the UK and Europe, right? So in the UK and Europe, you know, failure is seen as failure, right? Rather than an opportunity to learn. And I think that actually makes it a lot harder to be an entrepreneur in the UK and Europe, because that's changing, I think, for sure. But, you know, amongst the kind of wider peer group, you know, failure is seen as a very negative thing. Whereas I think in the US, you have much more of an ecosystem that allows people to rise back up quickly rather than beat themselves down constantly over where they, you know, where they haven't had successes. And I think that's really important. And I think the other thing I would say about the UK and Europe is probably, I always talk about it in terms of VC being more akin to private equity, and that it's just got slightly more risk aversion. I think there's still an element of that lack of risk taking at the very earliest stages here in the UK compared to the US. And I think that changes things.
Yeah, I think you're picking up on that. Or I think that's because a lot of investors from Europe and the UK, at least when I was there, and my knowledge may be outdated because I've left in 2019, but in comparison to the US, a lot of investors in the UK and Europe seem to come from iBanking and private equity, where they're used to seeing KPIs and traction and, you know, proof of product, proof of market, you know, proof of customers, all these things. That in the US, when a seed deal comes to us, we're just looking, you know, ideally, yes, at this point, we're raising $8 to $10 million seed rounds. Like, they're the old Series A. So the pre-seeds are really the new seed in the US. But in the pre-seed round, you know, we're hoping for a big dream and amazing team. And that's about it. Because a lot of us came from operations. A lot of us have built startups before. And so we know the reality of the situation, whereas I felt like a lot of people I was working with were a bit unrealistic when I was in the UK about what to expect of a founder at that stage.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to nick big team and amazing dreams. I hadn't heard that before, and I'm really glad you said that, because I think that's exactly it. I think it is very much that kind of finance-driven, spreadsheet-driven approach to investing versus, I think, the much more intrinsic kind of, you know, taking a bet on that future. And in fact, like you talked on a previous pod about using both your analytical skills as well as your gut when you're assessing a deal. But, you know, given the range of verticals and business models you must look at across all of the funds that you're, you know, you have involvement in, which one do you rely on most, or has that changed over time? And is there anything that founders leave out when pitching you that frustrates you? And do you think there's an ideal way to manage the fundraising process?
Great question. I want to make one more comment to the previous question, which is there are exceptions to every rule, because I actually think the UK, I hope, is getting better. It was more the stuffy traditional funds I was thinking of when I was saying a lot of I bankers and PE folks. Like if you think of, and you look at like, you know, some of them out there that are more entrepreneurial, there are a lot of those now in the UK, and I hope that they'll take over the ecosystem. So
yeah, for sure. Funds like Hoxton, like Stride Ventures.
Exactly. Passion, Seed Camp.
Yeah, correct.
I was exactly what I was thinking of. Although I think Hussein did come from banking, didn't he?
He came from banking. He came from, he'd worked in startups as well. And then he went into venture in the US. And then, there's a whole thing, I think.
Yeah. So I think there are definitely exceptions to that rule. It just felt very banking heavy, especially when I first got there and had just left the Valley. In comparison, it was a very strong comparison. To your question about analytical skills, gut to assess a deal, I look at a combination of everything. So, you know, traditional due diligence, pattern recognition is really helpful from, you know, 10 plus years off and on in VC. And then my gut to make a deal decision. In the last year, I've certainly declined deals. I can think of one in particular where it just didn't feel right. And we'll have to just wait and see if I was right or wrong about that one. But in the past, when I've trusted my gut, it's been dead on. Both directions, as in like this company is going to take off, this founder is going to be successful, and this company is going, you know, something's off here. And I can't put my finger on it, but I'm not going to invest. I have been wrong once on this is going to take off, but I still believe that founder is going to take off. And that's a lesson I learned was at times, especially with a young founder, you can meet the founder and say, oh my gosh, this person is 100% going to be successful. And it's just the wrong company that they're building. And maybe their next one is the right one or the next one after that. And then around, you know, pattern recognition, I think you learn over the years what to look for. What are the red flags? What words do founders use or tones do they use that you need to dig in on those things that they're saying at that time? You know, what questions to ask, how to frame them even, how to manage the whole process. Founders, you know, really skilled salesmen can play tricks too. So you have to figure that out. You know, are they one that I think founders do a lot, which I appreciate. I'm an ex-founder myself. I consider myself an entrepreneur. But they'll give you fake deadlines for the fundraise. And I've won too many times, worked my ass off to hit their deadline and then found out it wasn't a real deadline. You know, the wiring is not happening. The decision did not need to be made on that date. So now I really push back, and you learn that with time. I cannot say I rely on one of those things, DD, pattern recognition, or my gut more than the other. I think they're all important. And is there anything that a founder leaves out that frustrates me? No. I think that it's really important, or it's, you know, it's, I'd say it's very rare usually to find, actually not, that's not true. I guess because I'm an empath, I think that's probably why. I don't get frustrated with founders very often. I feel like they're doing the hardest possible job that you could probably do. And I just feel a lot of empathy for the position that they're in, trying to run their company while also build out around, which is essentially like running a second company. So no, there's not much that founders do that frustrate me. Ideally, the best way to manage a fundraising process, this is one thing I love to tell first-time founders or first-time fundraisers. I would make a list of all of the VCs you think will be interested in your company. Check, make sure they're not investors in any of your competition, and then rank them 1, 2, or 3. One being the lowest, like I'm least excited about this one, and 3 being I'm the most excited about this one. And then set your schedule out so that you're going, you're first pitching the ones, then you're pitching the twos, then you're pitching the threes, but stack it so that you can create some momentum and FOMO. Once you get to the twos, hopefully you've practiced your pitch enough on the ones. And then once you get to threes, you've got your pitch down, you've got all your docs ready. You hopefully have raised a portion of the round so that by the time you get there, you can say, look, we're looking for our lead. We've already raised, you know, 700K out of a $1.5 million round. Would you like to come in for $1 million and we can put the round up to 1.7 or whatever it may be? And that just creates this kind of a fire under the investor's bum, as you would say in London, because they have to move quickly versus when you get an email and no money has been raised and there seems to be no momentum from a founder you've never met before. So there's nothing, you know, no relationship there. It's less likely it's going to get to the top of your priority list. And because we're constantly getting deals in, it's important to be prioritized and actually get some time right away. Otherwise, if you go at the very beginning to like a top tier investor, you have no relationship and you're a first-time founder, likelihood of them prioritizing you, unless you're like the first employee at Oculus or something, is probably pretty low. And then 3 months later, you're still looking for your lead and they're going to think, this company couldn't raise in 3 months or bring any capital in 3 months. This must be a signal that something's not right. And I'm still not going to prioritize it. And unfortunately, there is a lot to be said about FOMO strategy within this process.
Yeah. And I think that FOMO strategy is, you talked about it earlier in terms of the kind of arbitrary or artificial deadlines. And I think one of the reasons for that is it seems to be the most, certainly anecdotally looking on Twitter, it seems to be the most common piece of advice, right? Like create that FOMO, set an artificial deadline and try and, you know, push the investors to come to a decision. I kind of take a very different attitude to the fundraising process, having not raised from VCs specifically, but I have VC partners on my cap table. One of the things that I very much did with no intention actually at the outset was building relationships with them over the last 5, 6, 7 years, not even knowing if I was ever going to build a business that might require venture backing in the future. But I think one of the things that it's really important to do is to build those relationships early, not tap into them, not sort of use them transactionally, but really build those relationships well. And, you know, then have the conversations as and when they come up. And I think, you know, even with the VCs that, you know, said to me, you know, this is maybe it's too early or we're not in this vertical, or whatever, the feedback you get as a result of having built those relationships is massively valuable. And to your point, it kind of, you know, you have that 1, 2, 3 sort of list of investors that can be absolute gold dust.
Yeah. But can I just drill down on one thing you said, which is really important? Make it a real relationship. Don't make it transactional.
Sure.
I can't tell you the number of founders that have pretended to be my friend. And actually, when I first got to London, I fell for it every time. And it actually hurt my feelings a lot because I thought these people were my real friends. And it turned out it was a very transactional relationship. And, you know, I just ask, be human, you know, like founders want investors to treat them with respect and vice versa. And so if you're going to go and, you know, think strategically long-term about building those relationships, either do it with the full transparency that, you know, you're trying to build relationships with smart people. You're a smart person. They're going to like you and what you can bring to the table just as much as vice versa. Or, you know, make it a real friendship where that person doesn't feel fake.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think there's a couple of kind of additional points to that. One of them is, yes, absolutely. It should never be transactional. But one of the ways to build a relationship is to be useful and, you know, maybe forward on deals that are happening where, you know, they're, you know, in verticals maybe that investor's interested in. I think that can be really valuable. I think the other thing is, you know, there is this difficulty that there is this seemingly asymmetrical relationship or potential for an asymmetrical relationship. And I think some founders, and I think in the UK, it's changing a bit now, but there used to be a kind of, you know, deification, I guess, of investors. And therefore there was this feeling that, you know, you couldn't be an investor's friend because there was this sort of, you know, big, bad kind of entity out there that, you know, you could only talk to when you need to raise capital and your fate and the fate of your business was in their hands. I think that's changed a lot again with some of these much more approachable VCs that are out there in the ecosystem and sort of more emerging fund managers. I think that dynamic has changed a great deal. I went one step further and I set up this podcast so I could just chat to even more kind of like cool people than I had access to in London. So yeah, so that's my little secret for today. But actually talking about the pod, like it is centered around the entrepreneurial ethos of, you know, shooting your shot. It's why I called it Nothing Ventured. As a founder, operator turned investor, which side of the table do you think drives the most impact? And across the various funds you worked in and on, many of them have strong theses around inclusion. How do you think that's improved since you first got into the venture ecosystem? As in, how has the attitude towards diversity and inclusion or the inclusivity in venture, how has that improved or changed?
So which side of the table do I think has the most impact? I mean, 100% the founders, there's no question about it. And if any investor tries to tell you differently, they're full of shit. I'm sorry, but we're providing capital and support network, but we are not building the company. And that is the hardest and most impactful job. So 100% founder. Across the various funds, yeah, most of them do have, you know, an inclusion angle. I run Tower View at Alumni with Greg, and we tend to choose deals. Actually, really proud that all of our deals out of Tower View 3 are positive impact that we've chosen. You know, we do get tagged in other funds deals, so that creates a very diversified portfolio in the end. And Gangels, obviously, we're investing in companies that have a minority founder and or a founder who wants to bring minorities to their board or to their exec team. And plus, all of our LPs are from minority categories. So that brings minority to the cap table, which is huge. How has it changed since I first got into the venture ecosystem? It's actually, it has and it hasn't. So from the investor side, it feels like it's changed a lot. It feels like there are a lot more female partners. We have a ways to go. I think I tweeted maybe 6 months ago, I have my hands on the list of the top, quote unquote, top tier funds in Texas. And out of all the partners, there were only like 5 or 6 females, something like that. So, I mean, we still have a ways to go, but it definitely feels like we're moving in that direction. And even if we're not moving actively, there's a lot of lip service being done. So that's better than nothing. Around the female founders, I believe that the amount of funding that a company that has at least one female founder has been able to raise has remained constant around 12% since 2011. And only 2 to 3%, depending on what stat you look at, of venture funding goes to a fully female funded team, and less than 1% to founders of color. So we have, you know, we've made progress in the sense that there are new funds that focus on, you know, founders of color, female founders. There are more recruiters looking for, you know, and funds therefore looking to bring diversity to their team and to their investment team specifically. However, we still have eons of work to do, or, you know, a lot. And I will say the statistic I was referring to above or earlier was that we can actually create better returns if we bring in diversity at all levels into the team. Women funded companies from First Round Capital's portfolio outperform companies funded by men by 63%. I love that statistic because it's just, okay, there are no excuses not to look at this and really take it seriously and try and make unbiased decisions. And also not just that, but seek out minority founders. I mean, look at Unshackled, for example. I love that fund. You know Unshackled, based in California. They only invest in founders that are immigrants. They have incredible returns.
I will be looking for them.
Yeah, imminently. I'm happy to reach out to one of their partners and see if they'd want to be on the podcast. But I think we just, in summary, we've made progress. It feels like we've made progress, but when you look at the statistics, we still have a ways to go.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of those kind of really endearing moments of we've started moving, but we're not there yet, right? And I tweeted this out a few months ago. We talk often, and certainly I do on this podcast, we talk about female founders, we talk about, you know, ethnic, you know, people from diverse ethnic backgrounds as founders. But it goes way beyond that. There is obviously the LGBTQIA+ community. There is also the neurodiverse community. There are hundreds, you know, of underrepresented communities out mm-hmm. there. And I think, you know, if we can get to a place where we start breaking down barriers for all of them, you know, that is where we start really making progress.
100%.
Yeah, but I think ultimately we should be absolutely, you know, positive about the fact that there is progress being made. Nancy, it's been absolutely awesome having you on the podcast. I can't thank you enough. For our listeners, where can they find you online? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you?
I'm on both. I'm on Instagram as well. I do not use TikTok, but Twitter is just my name. Nancy Fechne is my handle. And that's where I interact probably the most with people. And I'm actually better at Twitter than I am at clearing my LinkedIn inbox. And on Instagram, my account's private, but I tend to sometimes just accept anybody. And it's Nancy LeMaster, which is my middle name. It's LA Master.
Amazing. Nancy, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been great.
Oh, it's been really fun. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.